Do you feel like you need God's encouragement and wisdom throughout the week to take hold of His promise to fly like an eagle? You come to the right place. Welcome to Eagles on the Hill. Let's join our host, Pastor Jeff Scheich.
Hey, people, I am your host, Pastor Jeff Scheich. Thanks for joining us on this edition of the podcast. Today, we're going to do something we've done periodically for quite a while, since October the 7th, and that is an update on the Israel-Hamas war, conflict, whatever you want to call it. So we want to give you an update on that, in part because we just passed Yom HaShoah, which is the Day of Remembrance of the Holocaust in Israel. I've been in Israel for Yom HaShoah, and it is a powerful experience to be there. What happens is, at 10 o'clock in the morning, a siren goes off and everything stops. Literally, everything comes to a stop in Israel. It's powerful to watch if you're near a highway and can see this happen. All the cars stop immediately. And everyone gets up, stands outside of their car, and stands in silence for a minute. And it is so quiet. If you're in Jerusalem when this happens, and the hustle and bustle of the city comes to a complete stop and just silence in remembrance of the Holocaust. So we just passed Yom HaShoah, and what happened on October 7th was the greatest slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. And so that brings to mind what went on October 7th, having passed Yom HaShoah. It brings to my mind, how are things going there since October the 7th? We want to remember on October the 7th what started this whole conflict, at least this version of the conflict, this very intense version of the war, and that is that Hamas invaded Israel in the south, mostly invaded communities that were full of what we call peaceniks, people who were trying to create peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and invaded them. They brutally tortured, raped, murdered, mutilated over 1,000 Israelis, babies, elderly women, and everyone in between. It was the worst slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. And they also took captive over 200 hostages. So Hamas started this conflict, this war. And now, of course, Hamas says, well, we want Israel to declare a ceasefire. We don't want Israel to seek justice against the murderers and thugs who committed these atrocities. Well, I don't think Israel is going to do that. So where do we stand today? What's the situation? I'm recording this on Monday, May the 6th. I'm going to release this video and this podcast on Tuesday, May 7th. So it may be out of date slightly by the time you hear it. But as of Monday, May 6th, where do we stand? Well, I want to cover a few topics, the first of which is the hostages. Because the hostages are on the minds of Israelis. Top, center, foremost in their minds. The goals of this war, when after Hamas invaded Israel, the goal of Israel in this war was twofold. One was to bring the hostages home, over 200 hostages. And the other goal was to eliminate Hamas from Gaza. You will recall, hopefully, that Gaza has been ruled by Hamas for almost 20 years. There has been no Israeli presence, no Jews, living or dead, in Gaza for these last 20 years. It has been essentially a two-state solution, Israel and Gaza. And this is what Hamas has done with the two-state solution. They have invaded Israel. So the goals of Israel were to bring the hostages home and to eliminate Hamas. And sometimes those goals support each other. Sometimes they're in conflict with each other. And there's a great conflict within the nation of Israel as to which goal should take priority. Of course, with these hostages, you have to have, I certainly sense, a great compassion for what these hostages are going through. I have no idea of the horrors they're going through. I can only imagine the horror of the families of the hostages. And whatever I imagine, I have to think it's worse than what I can imagine. So our hearts go out to the hostages and to the hostage families. And of course, in Israel, people are very interconnected. And so it is everybody in Israel either knows a hostage, knows a family, is connected somehow. It's just it's a tightly connected community there in Israel. So what Israel has done in the past, they've handled these hostages previously differently than United States, for instance, has handled hostages when we've had hostages taken. Israel has negotiated for the release of hostages. And that's just common knowledge that for the last 75 years, they do that. And so when they negotiate for the release of innocent hostages, part of that negotiation is an exchange of criminals, hardened criminals, terrorists convicted of mayhem and murder that are sitting in Israeli jails. So essentially, what Israel has done over these last 75 years and continues to do today seems to me to be equating the lives of innocent hostages with the lives of those convicted of murder and mayhem. I find that to be a problem, to have an exchange of those two groups, but Israel has done that. Why? Because of the compassion in their hearts, which I understand. And there's a saying in the Talmud, if you save one life, you save the world. And so Israel has this sense, if we can save the life of a hostage, we've saved the world. This was put into practice, for instance, famously in 2011. Let me tell you that story, and you'll see where I get my sense of what Israel should or should not be doing. In 2006, Hamas, just having taken over the Gaza Strip, had a cross-border raid into Israel, and this time they only got one hostage. He was serving in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. His name was Gilad Shalit, and they took him hostage. And for 5 years, Israel negotiated his release. In 2011, they finally got him released, and it was a time of great joy in Israel when Shalit came home. Well, how did they get him released? They exchanged 1,027 Palestinian prisoners convicted of all sorts of crimes against Israelis, including murder. They released 1,027 of those prisoners for one innocent hostage, Shalit. So, well, you might say, well, it's worth the life of one person. And I would agree. And yet, one of those 1,027 hostages is named Yahya Sinwar. You may or may not know that name, but Yahya Sinwar is the current head of Hamas in Gaza. He is the one who gave the green light for October 7th and for the slaughter of October 7th. So one of the hostages to release Shalit, one of the prisoners that was exchanged, is now the head of Hamas who initiated the October 7th slaughter. Was it worth it to bring Shalit home? You'd have to be a judge of that yourself. But what we see is this cycle of violence continuing because of the release of all of these prisoners. And my opinion is that Israel needs to play the long game here. Of course, there is this compassion for the hostages and their families. And so Israel, to a certain extent, bargaining with Hamas right now is not necessarily doing that. They're not necessarily playing the long game here. They might be saving the lives of a few hostages, but they're going to wind up with many, many more Israelis dead in the long run. It appears that, as of today, Hamas is not going to release those hostages unless forced to do so. Not surprising, because they're using them as human shields to protect themselves against an Israeli invasion. And so Israel sits ready to take out the last city, to go into the last city, I should say, in Gaza, Rafah, and to battle the Hamas battalions there, and it appears that that is going to be underway. My sense with these hostages is, this is how it should have worked from day one. Instead of the cries in Israel of bring them home, which put the onus on the Israeli government and the world to bring the hostages home, it would have been much better if the whole world, including those in Israel, had cried out, let my people go. A saying inspired by the words of God through Moses to the Pharaoh back in the day. When God said to Pharaoh, let my people go, they were enslaved in Egypt, and God said, let them go. The whole world, including Israel, should have said to Hamas, let my people go. A universal condemnation of Hamas, universal pressure on Hamas to release those hostages, and universal assistance given to Israel to destroy Hamas. And yes, innocent civilians would have been harmed in Gaza, as has happened. But that is not Israel's fault. That is Hamas's fault. We'll talk about that under the next heading, Gaza. So let's talk about Gaza and what's happening in Gaza. In Gaza, it is said by the Hamas ministry there that 35,000 people have been killed by Israel. Well, number one, that number is very suspect. So I would not count on that number being true. But if it is true, we must understand that is not genocide. If Israel wanted to wipe out the Palestinians, they have the power to kill far, far more than 35,000. Israel is not committing genocide against the Palestinians. We need to be clear what genocide is and genocide is not. Nazi Germany was committing genocide against the Jews and killed 6 million. Israel is not committing genocide. And in addition, even if that number of 35,000 is true, it is miraculous given all the battle that has taken place and given the way Hamas uses these poor innocent Palestinians as human shields, these women and children. It's miraculous that Israel has only killed that number, although I don't think the number is true. I think it's less than that, but I have no way, of course, of proving that. Anyway, what will happen in Gaza now? Eventually, in some way, shape, or form, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, will move against Rafah and will continue to dismantle Hamas. They simply must, and it will happen. It is simply carrying out justice against these fighters that invaded Israel and committed mass murder, mayhem, rape, torture, and all the rest. My sense is, though, that Israel should never have committed to dismantling Hamas as a stated goal of the war. That may surprise you. I'll say it again. My sense is that Israel should not have said that dismantling Hamas is a goal of the war. Why not? Because I don't think it's possible to completely dismantle Hamas without killing far, far too many civilians in Gaza, without life in Gaza becoming simply unbearable for the people who live there. Hamas is too embedded within Gaza, and the philosophy of Hamas is embedded in all the schools in Gaza for the last 20 years. And so the Palestinians in Gaza, all 2 million of them, probably, I don't know what the polls say, but 80, 90% of people in Gaza support Hamas. How can you get rid of and dismantle Hamas completely? It should not have been a goal of the war. Jesus says in Luke 14, suppose a king is about to go to a war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he's not able, he'll send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and ask for terms of peace. Frankly, Hamas is, as we just said, pervasive in Gaza. It's not just an army of 10 or 20,000. It's an army of over a million, not all armed, but in their attitude, in their thoughts, in their the way they view the world through the same lens that Hamas does. They are anti-Semitic to the core, many of those who live in Gaza. So Israel should not have set out to do what they're claiming they want to do. They'll never be able to accomplish it. Finally, what's going to happen in Gaza, in my opinion, you can listen to this in a few months and see if I'm correct. My sense is that Israel is going to destroy much of the Hamas infrastructure. That's what the goal should have been, to destroy the Hamas infrastructure, not Hamas. And then Israel is going to try to get some kind of international agreement together to eliminate the terror threat from Gaza, which finally will be impossible. The situation in Gaza is going to finally resemble the situation currently in the West Bank, which we'll talk about in a second, where there's continued skirmishes and there is also a Israeli presence. There's going to be a renewed Israeli presence in Gaza when this is all over, which needs to happen, actually, if Hamas is to be seen by fellow Palestinians and Arabs as losing the war. There must be a presence of Israel in Gaza when this is all over, if Hamas is to be seen as losing the war. All right. I want to come back to Iran and the West Bank and the North and all of that stuff in a minute, but I want to take a break from what's going on in the Middle East and talk about what's happening in the United States, particularly on university campuses. As you hopefully know, on university campuses around the United States, well over 100, we only hear about a couple in the news, but it's well over 100 university campuses. There are protests, sometimes peaceful protests, as at the University of Nebraska thus far, and sometimes violent protests, sometimes riots going on university campuses. Where is this coming from? Well, it's coming from a couple of places. Number one, there's outside agitators coming in to these campuses. Clearly, that's at work here, outside money coming in to these campuses. There are people who are against Israel and against the United States, and they're moving into these campuses. But what they're finding on the campuses is fertile ground for these protests. Why is it fertile ground? Because of what's been taught in the universities over these past 20 years. Critical theory. This is not the time for me to go into critical theory in depth, but one of the tenets of critical theory is that the world could be divided into groups. And in this particular case, groups of oppressors and the oppressed. oppressors, like the United States, for instance, everything they do is wrong. Everything oppressors do is evil. The oppressed, in this case, Palestinians, the oppressed, everything that the oppressed do is good. They cannot sin. They cannot do wrong. And so October the 7th is not wrong because it was done by oppressed. Everything Israel does as an oppressor, that's the lens in which they're viewing it, everything Israel does is wrong. Everything that Palestinians and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah and all those groups, Iran, everything they do is right because they're the oppressed. That's the fertile ground that's been tilled in these universities. And now these outside agitators are coming in and finding a lot of fertile ground to grow some anti-war protests, as they call them. However, these are not anti-war protests. We need to make that clear. If these were anti-war protests, they'd be protesting the war in Ukraine and the war in Gaza, but they're not. This is anti-Israel protest. This is anti-oppressors protest. They're protesting against Israel. They're protesting against the United States. These are anti-Semitic protests. The bizarre thing is that these people, especially these university students, know nothing about Israel. Israel is the most, you don't know this as a listener, Israel is the most LGBTQ plus friendly nation in the Middle East. Israel is the most progressive nation in the Middle East. Tel Aviv, you probably have heard of that city in Israel. Tel Aviv is known as the San Francisco of the Middle East for good reason. Go to San Francisco, go to Tel Aviv in Pride Month, you'll see the same things going on. Pride parades galore, pride flags all over Tel Aviv. These protesters would love the city of Tel Aviv if they went there and understood what goes on in Israel. On the other hand, if these protesters were to go to Gaza and hang a pride flag outside their house, well, they would receive the death penalty. And so they're protesting on behalf of a people who would give them the death penalty. It is bizarre. And they're protesting against the country, the very country where they could fly a pride flag with pride. The anti-Semitism and the lack of wisdom is shocking in these protests. Now, here's a prediction. And again, listen back in a few months, see if my prediction is true. Most of these protests can either be let them happen or they can shut them down. And who's responsible for that is governors and mayors. That's who's responsible for that. Mayors of these cities, mayors of New York City, for instance, with the protest at Columbia. That's who's responsible to either shut down the protests or let them happen. My prediction is that in 2024, these protests will be shut down by the mayors of these large cities. They were not shut down by the mayors of large cities in 2020. Why the difference? Well, here's what you need to know. Of the 50 largest cities in the United States, 49 of them have Democrat mayors, and one has a Republican mayor. You can research which one it is. I know, but I'm not going to tell you. In any case, 49 have Democrat mayors. In 2020, the protests were seen by the Democrat mayors as harming the incumbent Republican president who was running for re-election, Donald Trump. And so they let those protests go on and on and on because they were seen as harming the re-election chances for President Trump. In 2024, these Democrat mayors are going to shut these protests down. Why? Because the protests are seen as harming the incumbent president, a Democrat, President Joe Biden, who's running for re-election. And so my prediction is that these protests in 2024 will be shut down, even and with language that would be shocking if it were applied to the protests in 2020. You check it out, see what happens. Come back in a few months, we'll see if I'm right. All right, let's go back overseas to close this out. I want to talk for a moment about Iran, because Iran is behind all of this in the Middle East. There was a absolutely stunning defense of Israel in the middle of April, as over 300 drones, missiles, and rockets were intercepted by Israel and its allies. Only a few landed in Israel. Only, as far as I know, one young Bedouin girl was hurt in that incredible attack against Israel. Bedouins, by the way, are Arabs, Palestinians. So Iran is shooting these rockets, and the only person they hurt was an Arab. The only person they hurt was a Palestinian. It's a crime, literally. But anyway, my immediate reaction, I think that happened on a Saturday, my immediate reaction that day was that Israel should not strike back, but that the U.S. and its allies, including Sunni Arab nations in the Middle East, should strike back against Iran forcefully against their nuclear capabilities that they are developing. Why? To show that this was not an Iranian-Israeli conflict, but rather this was a conflict of the dictatorship in Iran against the free world, against the Western world, and yes, against our Sunni allies in the Middle East, namely Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Bahrain, etc. That's not what happened. The United States certainly didn't strike back. And so, in fact, President Biden warned Israel not to retaliate and did not retaliate himself. Neither did any other nation around the world. We basically said, you know what? You shot 300 rockets at us. You didn't hit us. Na-na-na-na-na-na. And that was that. What message did that send to Iran? The message that sent to Iran was, why not send 300 more? Nobody's going to do anything about it. I don't know if that's the right message to send to Iran. Is that how the United States would have reacted had Iran attacked us with 300 drones, missiles, and rockets? Well, hopefully we'll never find out. But I hope not. I hope that would not be our reaction. Well, we stopped all the rockets, so I guess you can keep firing them at us. In any case, what happened was Israel reacted in a very small way and yet a very powerful way. Israel reacted by publicly letting Iran know that its nuclear site was vulnerable. They took out some installations right around their nuclear site to let Iran know that the site was vulnerable, and that was it. Trying desperately to please the West, trying desperately to please President Biden in particular, and show restraint in that area. We'll never know the extent of Israel's reaction. I think they're going to continue to react in ways that will be unseen, unheard, perhaps, but Israel is not going to let this go long-term. It's going to take place over many years. Eventually, both Israel and the West are going to have to deal with Iran. Otherwise, there will not be peace in the Middle East. Iran is the cause of all the problems going on over there. So eventually, we're going to have to deal with them, but not today. Let me close out this way, talking about the West Bank and also Lebanon and Hezbollah, the other borders around Israel. The West Bank is a place where millions of Arab Palestinians live and also Israelis live, and there is an Israeli presence there, and there's continued kind of low-level conflict in the West Bank as Palestinians try to attack Israel and Israel attacks back, and it's been going on for a long, long time and will continue to go on. I referenced earlier that Gaza is going to now become like the West Bank, I believe, in that Israel will now have a presence in Gaza and will have these low-level skirmishes that won't really affect life inside Israel, but will affect life in the West Bank and Gaza. Until such time as the world pressures the Palestinians, until such time as the Palestinians change their religion, essentially, we've talked about that in other podcasts, there's going to be continued conflict there in the Middle East. What about up north? Hezbollah, Lebanon. Will Hezbollah attack Israel? My sense is no. Listen in a couple of months, see what takes place. My sense is that once Israel goes into Rafah, once there is then declared a ceasefire in Gaza, that there will also be a ceasefire temporarily in the north between Hezbollah and Israel. Israel does not want to fight Hezbollah at this point. They're not ready for that, I don't believe, in a way that they would like to be prepared for it. And Hezbollah does not want to fight Israel either. So I believe that there will be a ceasefire in the north once there is a ceasefire in Gaza. Well, that podcast went a little bit longer than we like to typically go, but we had a lot to cover to give you an update on Israel and Hamas. Write me at eaglesonthehill211@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this podcast. Let me know in a couple of months as you re-listen to it how I did in my predictions, some of those predictions that I gave. Remember that those who hope in the Lord will fly on wings like eagles. Thanks for listening to the podcast today.